Now, this August, we're nearly in August, marks 100 years since the first licensed broadcast of radio ever occurred on the island of Ireland. It was a significant event for the citizens of Ireland and those pioneering broadcasters who aired those first programmes in 1923. To mark the centenary of 2BP on the 12th of August, that was the name of the station, 2BP. So to mark the centenary on the 12th of August, there will be an event in the Royal Marine Hotel, in the exact same room that the first ever licensed broadcast took place. Organiser of the event and Irish radio historian Eddie Bowen joins me now to tell us about the origins of 2BP and the spark in Irish broadcasting it ignited. And I suppose the reason we're here today, Eddie, isn't it? Without them, we wouldn't be here today.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Had to start somewhere.
I did, yeah. Now, you're what they call in the business an anorak.
100%.
Yeah. Will you explain to people who don't know what an anorak is?
An anorak is just... In the good old days, I suppose more associated with pirate radio, where you'd wear an anorak and stand outside and you'd be kind of listening to radio under the tree.
Right.
More than likely, you're probably running an aerial up the tree so you could get a better signal. But that's what an anorak is. And I go back into the very first radio I got. One of those great men called Santa Claus brought me a radio and it just
opened.
What age
were you?
I'd say I was about 6 or 7 when I got it.
So that's 50-odd years ago.
Yeah, it was. We had the old bush radio in the kitchen, which was always high enough that you couldn't reach to change the station.
And that was probably stuck on Radio 1.
Oh, Radio Ayrton. Yes. That was it. Never moved off it. Then, of course, when I got a little bit older and a little bit more agile, I was able to get up and tune it. And then, of course, I was encouraged, I think. I was probably encouraged to look for a transistor radio again. It was just fascinating to me that I had this piece of equipment with batteries, no wires, and I got the world. Languages I never heard, music I never heard, and it opened up.
It
was a global experience.
Yeah, wireless, of course. That's the ultimate expression. Wireless. And as you went down the dial, did you stop at Luxembourg?
I stopped at Luxembourg. And I suddenly found Radio Caroline.
Yeah.
My two great passions in life from radio came from that. It was a huge fan of Meatloaf. First time I ever heard was on the radio. And I became a very big American football fan by listening to the American Forces Network.
Uh-huh.
So I became a Washington fan and I still am.
And they were all on medium wave.
All on medium wave. FM had not really taken off. FM wouldn't have probably come to the late 70s. Again, probably the pirate era brought in FM.
Yeah.
But it was all medium wave and some long wave.
Right. So you're an expert, are you, on radio in Ireland, pirate radio stations?
Pirate radio primarily is probably my thing. I'm involved in the Irish Pirate Radio Archive out in DCU.
So would you know what pirate radio stations I was on?
Absolutely, yeah, down in Kildare, yes. Yes, that caravan, yes.
yeah, that was one of them. That was the middle one. Yeah. I started off on KCR, which is Radio Vinta Kildare, and that broadcast out of Naas. And we had... a fertiliser bag over the record decks to stop the rain coming in. That was the first
Needs
one.
Must.
Needs must. Needs and must. Then the caravan out the road, that was WKRC or something.
WKRC, yeah.
And then there was KLB, Kildare Local Broadcasting, which was nearly official.
Professional.
Yeah, nearly.
Nearly professional.
Nearly professional.
You were moving up the ranks.
yeah.
You were coming out of the garden shed and into the living room.
But they were all officially illegal, weren't they?
Oh, 100%, right up until 1988.
Is that when local stations got licences?
Licence, yeah. They several times tried to get rid of pirate radio over the years, tried to bring in legislation, and of course nobody grasped a nettle, mainly because nobody wanted to upset the young people who were all listening to pirate radio. So eventually in 1987... Fianna Fáil government decided that it was time to bring in licensed radio. But up to the 1987, like on a weekend, you could have 150 pirates across Ireland on the air. Oh, yeah.
We played a bit of Jim Diamond. Oh, I should have known better.
Radio
which reminded
Novus.
Me of
Nova
P- Care. It was PhD.
Yeah.
And what was the name of the song? I Won't Let You Down.
I Won't Let You Down. It was for Nova Care. Radio Nova would do their annual charity event and that was the song that they played.
And did they play it once they were going to be shut down?
They
blasted it out of the windows. And
in 1983 after the raids. Because he briefly came back on to say goodbye. And of course after a couple of weeks he was back on full time after the raids were in May 1983.
You do know your stuff, Eddie.
I'm just auditioning for Mastermind here.
Let's go back then, 100 years, 100 years. And of course, there was no radio then.
No, there was no radio, especially in Ireland. Again, you have to remember, we're only coming out of a civil war.
Yeah.
And prior to that, the War of Independence. So it was all...
And all radio broadcasting had been banned.
Well, the military were in charge of, and there was no licences been issued. So you couldn't broadcast anyway, but you couldn't listen either. so you weren't allowed, there was no licensing for listening.
Now, before we get to 2BP, will you describe that situation where the GAA were raising funds and they had this big fete stroke fair in Croke Park to raise funds?
Yes.
And there was a listening booth or a listening tent.
Yeah, and you paid extra to get into it. And it was probably the most successful event at the fete.
So what was it?
So you literally went into a tent
and
they had a radio with a couple of speakers on it, a couple of old-fashioned, as in, like what you'd know as the old gramophone speakers.
Yeah.
And they tuned in 2LO in London, and they tuned in Manchester, and they tuned in Cardiff, and 5NO from Newcastle, and they listened to all these English dance bands, and it was just fascinating. Young people were going in their droves. It was music they had never heard.
So they paid a shilling to go in and listen to the radio?
Yes. Yes. And was remarkably sold out on a number of nights that they had it there.
And I was just trying to imagine what it must have been like for them.
Oh, to hear, but it's just to hear this, like, A, to hear that type of music, and B, to know it was coming from London.
That's the thing, isn't it?
It was
to know that it was happening there, a thousand miles away.
Yeah.
And we could hear it through this.
Yeah, yeah, and through the ether.
Yeah, we take so much for granted, don't we, when it comes to technology.
It was described then as just listening in. There were listening in stations.
So you
weren't supposed to just listening, you were listening in.
Right.
It's almost you were earwigging.
Right.
You know. But these, they were full. Like, I mean, the reports in the newspapers at the time said that the Croke Park one, and there was loads of fetes, and wireless demonstrations was used as a marketing tool to get more people in.
Right.
And it was huge. For the Coombe Hospital, they had a fete up in Dolphin's Barn. And probably most of the money from the fete came from the listening in station.
Right. I wonder would you get away with it now? Well, people are saying, I don't know about the license fee, right? Right, okay. So then the government were toing and froing about giving out licences, and they offered up a licence for Dublin.
So,
Dublin area.
So they had the discussion. I mean, the pressure came on immediately. Once the Free State had been formed, the pressure came on to have their own licence station. And when they heard that Belfast was going to get one, Dublin wasn't to be left out. Now, there was people listening in. There wasn't in 1922 and probably the early part of 23, there was no licences, but people had radio sets. Dixon and Hempenstall were selling sets.
Dixon pickets. And Hempenstall?
Oh, they were the biggest.
Were they? That's where I got my glasses now.
Was it, yeah?
Yeah.
No, they were the biggest.
That's mad, isn't it? They were the largest
wireless distributor.
Were they?
Hogan's was another.
Right.
And Pickett's, as in McCulloch Pickett's.
Yeah.
So people were listening, but most people couldn't afford. Like, for a lot of people, a radio set was the first piece of furniture in the house they bought. Because when they got married, they were given everything as presents. The bed, the dresser, the cooker. But the first thing they went out and bought was the radio.
And it was a piece of furniture.
Oh, it was a piece of, but it was a luxury thing
to
have.
Yeah.
But a lot of people had the ingenuity then to create crystal sets, which were quite easy to make. So they were still able to pick up the stations in England.
So they were building their own radios?
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, God. Oh, it was, like, I mean, it was probably three times the amount of crystal sets than there was official sets.
So there was a bit of palaver about who should get the licence, wasn't there?
There was, in the end, there was. But at the time, J.J. Walsh, who was the Postmaster General and in charge of the department, or in charge of the post office, the GPO here, the pressure came on to him, and a lot of pressure came on to put on our own radio station, to have our own voice. But he wanted nothing to do with it. He didn't want to be in control of it. So he decided the best option here would be commercial radio. So that means the post office wouldn't have to worry about it at all. You know, all they'd have to worry about was collecting the licence fee. But they wouldn't have to worry about the commercial. They would give a licence out, same as the way as it is today. And that was the original plan. Just to skip over 2BP, in 1924, then they set up, the Dáil set up a wireless committee, and they did to discuss whether it should be commercial or state.
And they went state.
Well, they went state because the committee went into a bit of a political meltdown. There was a bit of a scandal over backhanders and Daryl Figgis, who was the TD, who was involved in it, unfortunately eventually committed suicide over it.
Gee,
in London.
Matters.
Yeah. So it was a kind of a touchy start to radio.
Okay. But so you've skipped on there
now.
So back to this was a local licence, if you
It was partly to do with a lot of people hoped that the RDS would run radio.
Right.
Because they had a big scientific department and they were respected.
The Royal Dublin Society.
Whose original headquarters, of course, was Dáil Éireann. before they got kicked out of that, much to their displeasure, because I've gone through their archives. So they were involved. It was the horse show a week, and J.J. Walsh said to Mark Honey, you set up a radio station, we'll see how it goes. So right. He gave them a license for a week to broadcast for the week of the horse show. So they decided to set up the station, the studio and the transmitters in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary. And they sent over a couple of men led by a man called Louis Wilson, who was head of his publicity department in London. And he sent him over to set up the station. And they did. They set it up in the Royal Marine.
To broadcast to the RDS.
Well, so the ideal was to broadcast to the RDS, but anybody within a 50-mile radius could
listen
to it.
If you had a radio.
But they set up listening stations in Dixon and Hempenstall and in Hogan's and in town. And anybody who had a crystal set, it was reports with the
loads
paper.
Of excitement. Oh, loads of excitement.
It was huge at the time.
We found this lovely piece. So they set it up and you're going to be there in the room, and you have a lovely book, The History of 2BP. You're going to be in the room, the Royal Marine Hotel, on what date?
12th of August. This is Saturday night.
Okay. And Renee Flynn.
Yes, she was one of the first broadcasters.
And she was interviewed about it in 1996. This is a lovely piece which paints a picture of what it was like back in 1923.
Many years ago when, oh gosh, I suppose I was, what age would I have been then? I was in my late teens. A party of people came over from the BBC and they started telephone. They got a little, do you remember, am I telling you something? A little room in the RDS. And they went in there and they had us out in the Marine Hotel. Of course, this is implicating a lot of old complications and implicating an awful lot of people. They set up a piano in a room and they had a telephone. And we sang into that telephone in the room in the Marine Hotel in Dunleary for the BBC, who had a little caboose in the RDS. And the people were paying their fourpences or the sixpences or whatever they paid then to go in and put on headphones and hear us singing out in the Marine Hotel in Dunleary. And that was the very first, the beginnings of anybody knowing anything about broadcasting.
In fact, they were the first broadcasters.
They were, but they were not doing it on a wide open basis. It was only between Dunleary and the RDS.
There you go. Now, Renee, who was an opera singer, it wasn't the BBC.
It was Marconi. Yeah. But she would have thought, because the BBC had actually only been instituted in 1923. It became the British Broadcasting Company.
Right.
It was a coalescing of a number of stations in England, like 2LO.
So that was it started at the weekend and it only lasted a few days then, did it?
So they started broadcasting on the Tuesday, the first day of the horse show. So they had put an ad in the newspapers for people to go out to, you know, get in touch with McCullough Pickets if you were willing to go out on the air. This was brand new. Nobody had ever heard of it. Yeah. And a lot of people were afraid of it. So a lot of the artists that got involved with it were from the Rap Minds and Ratgar Musical Society.
All musical acts they were looking for?
All, because sopranos and tenors sounded best on the radio at the time.
Right.
So that was, you know.
Somebody had decided that.
And they particularly really wanted women.
Okay.
Because their voice transmitted better. So that was mainly that. And when they didn't have artists out there, Pickets gave them gramophone records, which they played, which then was listened to in the caboose in the RDS.
And she mentioned their headphones. So
no, it wasn't actually headphones. No, it was just big speakers they had there.
And the telephone she describes was obviously a microphone.
But it was, would have been a telephone.
Oh, would it?
Would it looked like to her a telephone mouthpiece. That's the way it would have been set up in the old days. It looked like literally an old... One of those handsets. And it would have looked like a... and again, even in the pirate days, we used to use the mouthpieces from telephones.
And despite all your recordings of all the radio stations you have over the years, there's no recording of that, is there?
No, there's no even recording. I mean, the only snippet of the opening of 2RN in 1926 is from the BBC.
Right.
And that's of Douglas Hyde. And that's the only, there's no recording made.
And that's us, really, 2RN is us.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll be celebrating 100 years in 3 years' time.
Yes. Yeah, well, basically we're going into a decade of centenaries for radio. So in 23 was 2BP, 24 was 2BE in Belfast, 25 the first test transmissions are 2RN, 26 2RN, 27 is 6CK in Cork, and then in 1933 was the
Now,
Radio Ireland.
Will you give me an explanation for the B and the P and the R and the N?
So these were call signs, call letters handed out by the British Post Office.
Right.
No much choice in it. It was just given to them. The 2BP was actually for Marconi's publicity department.
Because it's not great, is it, as a name?
No,
for
it's not.
Radio
no,
station.
Well, 2BE.
2BP coming at you.
Yeah, no, not really. No, it doesn't work. No. But that was their station. That's okay. What their call sign
and
was.
And RN is, was.
Well, it was originally, it was 2RN, come back to Ireland. Come back to RN. Erin, come back to Erin. So that's why they got 2RN.
Right, right. Interesting.
2BE was Belfast.
Belfast.
And 2LO was London.
Yeah.
But some of them don't make any sense.
Right. Don't forget that the Atlantic 252 tower was demolished there the other day. Did you see that?
I did, yeah. And Tullamore went as well the day before.
Right. It's some amazing footage from that.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention it the other
day. Yeah,
yeah. How tall was it?
243 metres.
See, I knew I could ask him that before off the top of his head. Huh? Like, come on!
Eddie. I wasn't even getting a chance to phone a friend.
So, lovely book, The History of 2BP, Ireland's first licensed radio station. Eddie Bone is the author, and you're launching it on the...
We're launching it at the event on the 12th of August, and one of those who will be there will be Lorraine Barry.
And her connection is?
Is her great-aunt was the first woman to speak and play on 2BP, Victoria Clark Barry.
Right.
Her father was John Clark Barry, the famous orchestra leader.
There you go.
Who was in the RDS, listening to his daughter broadcasting from Dunleary.
And imagine, they were going, imagine that's 3.5 miles and we can hear them from here.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Insane to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're hard to impress now, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, the only thing that I can equate it to was the first time I ever made a mobile phone call.
Yeah.
The excitement of that, me doing that, I used a mobile phone belonging to someone else to ring home.
Yeah.
And I'm telling my dad, I'm on a mobile phone and he couldn't get it.
He couldn't get it right. Eddie, lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Ray.
We could talk about this forever, but we'd have no listeners at the end of it. Eddie Bone, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Take a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.